Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski, and we actually have two other big-time Docs Who Lift, the team from Barbell Medicine, Dr. Jordan Fagebaum and Dr. Austin Baraki. Today, we...
Also known as the Meatheads Who Lift.
The Meat Sticks.
This could be a whole new thing.
This is the Meat Sticks Who Lift.
And, you know, unfortunately, we don't have a female on here, so that... No,
we'll get that
next time.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of meat going on. Pheromones are flowing right now. So today we're going to be talking about inappropriate lab testing and inappropriate treatment for these inappropriate lab testing. And Dr. Austin had a little case that he presented to us through text, and he was like, "What do you think about this?" And we were like, "Oh, we're all like basically shaking our heads." So very dangerous.
And we've talked about this a lot for people listening. So, you know, plenty of our podcasts before have talked about in fact, I think we just had one recently, some red flags of quackery. We've talked to Hormones Demystified about the kind of the BS stuff that goes out there. A lot of unfortunate quack clinics, you know, make you pay a lot of money to spend some time with them and then order a bunch of inappropriate things and then try to sell you a bunch of supplements or inappropriate medications without ever getting to the root cause. And yet, part of their whole marketing campaign is claiming that mainstream evidence-based, science-based physicians don't get the root cause, right? But it's very ironic that they just then do this huge shotgun inappropriate approach without getting to the root cause. It's very ironic.
So Austin, yeah. Let's hear. Oh, go ahead, Jordan.
Well, it's like a pushback against not only big pharma, but like the cabal of big medicine, right? But it is ironic because on the backside, it's like, wait, so more tests, more medications I put in quotes because I'm like, how many of these things are actually approved for anything?
Ironic.
And if you can't get that, like if they're not approved for any indication, there's no actual manufacturer of them that's meeting all the, you know, pharmaceutical production guidelines and distribution and stuff like that. So you know what you're getting is safe. It's like, are people making this in their bathtub and then distributing it?
Yeah,
like,
it could be.
Yeah. Which, by the way, literally, apparently, people have been trying to do that with semaglutide.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Reconstituting it.
I mean, yeah, and we're already warning people about our potential concerns about compounding pharmacies. Definitely don't make it in your bathtub and don't trust somebody who might be.
Right, right.
So anyways.
So Austin, let's hear about this patient of yours.
Yeah. So this was a middle-aged gentleman who wanted to do a consult with me to, I guess, get another opinion on some of the things that he had been dealing with. And the main symptom of concern was fatigue, which is a common complaint to all of us here, I think. And it is a very complicated, you know, issue that people can deal with an extremely long differential diagnosis of possible causes and contributors and things like that. And it's often multifactorial. And so he had gone out and sought another consult with another organization, and they had ordered a massive slew of labs. And many of the labs were the kind of things that you guys have talked about before as being, you know, tests that are generally either not clinically useful or invalid or uninterpretable in certain contexts. And so obviously these labs all got done, all the results came back. And honestly, I was surprised that the overwhelming majority of them were normal, with the exception of some anemia, some iron deficiency, characterized mainly by an iron saturation of 13%, which less than 20% definitely gets my attention and would not be expected or appropriate in otherwise healthy, you know, appearing male.
Tell people what anemia is, just for anybody listening. They may not know.
Yeah.
People kind of know, but not really.
So anemia refers to a low amount of red blood cell mass, basically a decrease in hemoglobin. And that is the protein in our blood that helps us to carry around oxygen. And so obviously our tissues primarily need oxygen to be delivered to them to do their normal metabolic processes. And so when people have a decrease in the amount of hemoglobin and red blood cells that are circulating around in their bloodstream, they have a decrease in the capacity of their blood to carry oxygen, the decrease in the content of the oxygen, and therefore that can lead to problems with various, you know, metabolic processes and organ function and things like that. There are many, many, many different reasons why people can have anemia. A lot of folks automatically think of it in relation to iron, because iron deficiency is by far the most common reason that people can have anemia, but there are lots of other reasons. And this is a topic that I was also on one of our other friends' recent podcasts on Sigma Nutrition, talking about iron deficiency and anemia in general. And so that's kind of the situation that this individual found themselves in, is having unexplained anemia and iron deficiency. On the basis of these labs, which were, again, overwhelmingly normal aside from those two findings, this individual received a almost 25-page treatment plan, including dozens and dozens and dozens of both supplements and like pharmaceutical treatments that range from oral things to injectable things, hundreds and hundreds, probably several thousands of dollars that were that were ultimately recommended for this individual for an unexplained, you know, syndrome of fatigue, iron deficiency in a middle-aged male, which to anybody who has gone through proper medical training and residency is basically like blood loss until proven otherwise. And I was shocked by this.
Yeah. I mean, tell people, you know, because this is not totally uncommon. I mean, I think, you know, if there are females listening, there are a fair amount of females, you know, adolescent through adult females who have heavy menstrual cycles and have relatively obvious cause of an iron deficiency anemia, right? I think probably all of us have seen that, even in the endocrinology clinic. I'll come across that. You know, we get into obviously to menstrual cycles and stuff. But what are some other relatively common causes, but also like the really concerning things about you shouldn't be losing blood if you're, you know, in your 40s. I don't know. How old are you guys? Am I older than you guys?
30s.
I'm going to be mad at you. Yeah. Okay. I hate you guys. All right. So I'm like in my closing in on my mid 40s. So if I suddenly have anemia, I'm freaking out, right? So tell everyone why I'm freaking out.
Yeah. So, you know, there are many different kinds of anemias that people can have. And again, the most common being iron deficiency. And I basically break down iron deficiency into, you know, iron intake in the diet and then iron losses in some part of the body. And the most common areas where blood can be lost is through the gastrointestinal tract and the genitourinary tract, particularly through menses and things like that. But even aside from iron deficiency, there are other genetic conditions that can contribute to anemia. You can have you know, autoimmune conditions that can lead to destruction of your red blood cells. Your red blood cells can burst for various other reasons, infection related, medication related. So there's lots and lots of reasons why you can end up having anemia. In this situation, again, we had a situation of iron deficiency, and I am always very reluctant to blame iron deficiency on inadequate dietary intake alone before I have more thoroughly excluded potential sources of blood loss. And so, yes, menstrual blood loss is one that's common in young women. Although even by the time we get a little bit older, I'm still reluctant to blame it entirely on that, because that can easily be a way to miss more ominous or sinister causes of blood loss. And so then I'm still looking mainly at the gastrointestinal tract as a common source. And so then I kind of think about the whole path that iron has to take from dietary ingestion into the stomach, into the proximal small bowel, the duodenum, where, for example, you can have ulcers, you can have vascular malformations, you can have celiac disease. It's actually a relatively common and underappreciated cause of iron deficiency. And celiac disease, you know, is an example of something where people might view it as, oh, it's just a gluten thing, and if you stop, then it's fine. But, you know, celiac disease, if it goes undiagnosed and untreated for long times, it can lead to small bowel lymphoma. That's something that can happen in that situation. And then even further down the gastrointestinal tract, other sources of blood loss, blood vessels, and then most ominously would be in the colon, where people can have malignancies like colon cancer. And so we're all trained basically in our, you know, schooling and education that unexplained iron deficiency in an adult is pretty much colon cancer until proven otherwise, which means that you need to go through that evaluation to check for that. It's not that that's always the case, of course, but that would be the thing that is like a cannot miss sort of diagnosis. And that was never mentioned or brought up with this patient until I saw the numbers and I said, have you ever had a scope before? And it was like, no. And it's like, well, we need to go hunting now, because I do not feel comfortable until we take those diagnoses off the table.
That That's a board question. So we all do step one, step two, step three, and then we take our various specialty boards. And those, it's just, you can't miss that. Like, it's a just, you, right, you better not miss it. You better not miss it as a second year medical student.
Jordan has something to say.
Well, so there's, and then, you know, like after this, yes, that's like the first thing, do not pass go, do not collect $200 you've evaluated for GI related blood loss or similar. And then in, particularly in very, very active athletic populations, there's a whole nother like common set of issues that can cause iron deficiency anemia and anemia in general, one of which is the sort of exercise-induced hemolysis. This is effective, especially prevalent in marathon runners. They like smash the red blood cells as they circulate through their feet, for example. You can also get a pseudo-anemia via dilution for people who are sweating a ton and they expand their plasma volume. And so it looks like anemia, but you wouldn't see the iron deficiency. You would just see anemia. And so there are other causes, less nefarious, less ominous causes of anemia, but effectively none of this was suggested to this potential individual. It was just like, no, you need all these supplements and these medications and let's ignore the common things and effectively ignore his anemia in general.
You're right. Like, these things had nothing to do with his anemia. It's like had nothing to do with it. It's like, nah, screw it. Just have thousands of dollars of supplements and compounded medicines that have literally nothing to do with your underlying pathology. It's just insane.
I only got through the first four pages of the recommended sort of supplements.
Yeah.
And we're already looking at close to $3,000 a month. Just to like procure these things.
Yeah. And mind you, not just expensive things, but things certainly without benefit for, you know, especially without indication, but then a bunch of things that are actually being studied for a variety of ailments, not even close to approved yet, sometimes for good reason.
Yeah.
Like there are risks that outweigh the benefits. I mean, you know, one of them specifically, I noticed tesofensine, Spencer, you know, we've been paying attention to this medicine. It's, you know, it's a dopamine, serotonin, noradrenaline reuptake inhibitor in the brain. We've known about this as a being studied for obesity since we were in med school. It hasn't been approved yet. There might be a reason for that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like while all these other things have been, and that's just one of the many.
Well, there's a bunch of peptides on there that are, again, have not yet made their way into clinical practice due to various reasons, whether it's safety data not existing or efficacy data not existing, but effectively, many of these things are not FDA approved for any indication. And you're like, what are we doing here? Like, is this medicine or is this?
But they're making a ton of money for unclear risks and probably no benefit that I can imagine. And why the person has anemia.
I could see a few different outcomes from this situation. So let's say this guy goes, you know, all in on this treatment plan. There are a few different possibilities. Possibility number one is he ends up way worse. And I think that is the likely possibility if he were to go on 20
really
plus pages of medication and treatments, he would end up feeling horrible for a variety of reasons. So that's one possible outcome. The other possible outcome is he feels incredible. He feels like Superman. He feels way better because he's all hyped up on Mountain Dew, basically, on the equivalent of all these things, while missing potentially an undiagnosed colon cancer, right? Which is a very bad outcome, for which I assume...
That's actually... that would be my biggest fear that, you know, I always tell people, you know, when they want medications that are not really indicated for what's their underlying issue is... And they're like, yeah, but it'll make me feel better. It's like, well, okay, a lot of things could make you feel good. There are plenty of drugs. I'm pretty sure, and I'm not comparing some of what they're asking for to this, but, you know, pretty sure people take cocaine because they feel better.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's good for them.
High dose, you know what I mean? High dose prednisone makes you feel amazing for a few days.
Right. And that's right. And so, yeah, you don't need to tell me about how bad that is for people.
Yeah.
So anyways, but yeah, so that was actually my biggest concern is that this sort of thing would make people think, all right, you know, I feel great. I'm on tons of, you know, steroids and all these uppers and downers and everything like that. And yet they're dying slowly on the inside.
And that's just a more extreme version of what can happen when people say they have some anemia. Maybe it doesn't even get worked up any further. And they're just like, oh, anemia means I need iron. So I'll take iron pills. And maybe their iron stores improve and they feel better, but still they have ongoing blood loss. They have an ulcer that perfs. They have a cancer someplace. It's like, you know, for a lot of these people are coming to individuals like those who did this massive battery of mostly unnecessary testing, thinking that maybe often under marketing of like, we get to the root cause. And it's like, hold on here. Like, they didn't even get within any miles of the potential root cause of this potential thing.
I noticed they were throwing thyroid at him too.
Well, you got to,
of course.
Yeah, it makes you feel awesome. Sure.
Thyroid hormone.
Yeah, if you're thyroid toxic, you might feel fairly good at first, and then it'll catch up to you, and then you end up seeing me and hopefully make it to me.
Titrate to toxicity.
Or yeah. I see you for new onset AFib or something like that. Exactly.
Yeah. Which, I've seen that.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah. I mean, it's a selection bias, but I see that all the time. People are referred to me for their hyperthyroidism after their AFib is what actually triggered the evaluation all the time.
Spencer, I'm curious to get your and Austin's kind of take on this, because you guys are in this space. You know, what do you think motivates people to seek out this type of evaluation versus, all right, I have my PCP, I'm going to, you know, establish care with them and then get appropriately referred to people? Do you think it's like a dissatisfaction with their experience, or like seeking out, well, maybe there's another layer or level to this, and normal isn't good enough. I need to go to the next level.
Possibly the subclinical, like these videos are made on YouTube and wherever else to convince you that you're sick and that the normal levels aren't normal and that you're actually suboptimal. So that's part of it. It's possible that they went to their primary care and their primary care is like, everything's normal. Like, what else? You know, you're just tired because of whatever reason. Although if they went to the primary care, they would have picked up an anemia. That's pretty standard in these cases.
Yeah. Really standard.
We spoke to Hormone Demystified, and this is where he was like, talking about how they get all these tests, and the same exact type of situation. I think people aren't satisfied.
It's a combination, definitely a combination of things. I think that these sorts of subjective symptoms like fatigue are prime targets for this kind of thing. And we see the same thing with another subjective symptom of pain, because we deal a lot in musculoskeletal pain and rehab world. We see all sorts of nonsense marketed to people and done because subjective symptoms are very easy to like craft a compelling explanatory narrative around and then fit your proposed treatment modality into that if you are the person available to sell that to them, and then pair that with, you know, an extensive evaluation that the person is going to perceive to be more thorough, even when that may not necessarily be the case. It's a lot different than something that is much more clear cut, like a binary diagnostic thing. You have this or you don't. But these sorts of subjective things that, you know, you can just weave this really complicated narrative and then do a bunch of testing. It's like, oh my gosh, they're so much more thorough than my primary care doctor was, who had like a 20-minute appointment for me or less or something like that. So it's a problem.
And to that point, you know, let's be fair for part of why we have a problem. We have a healthcare system problem, not only in the United States, but in the world, right? So like you just said, the primary care doctor has 20 minutes. Well, that's not appropriate, because what you're saying is fatigue. This is a very complex potential issue, right? It might be able to be caught. In fact, a primary care doctor would have just caught this bam on an initial screen. Hey, we better make sure you don't have anemia. So that could have been taken care of immediately. Yep. But fatigue, I mean, think about, you know, as an endocrinologist, we often get patients for fatigue because primary care doctors did a pretty darn, maybe almost excessively thorough evaluation, but they only have 20 minutes. And so then luckily I have a little bit more time. We make sure there's not a hormone issue, which it could be, right? That's what we're looking for. But then I luckily get, you know, and I certainly have a passion for lifestyle. I talk to them like, look, we got to be very holistic. The primary care tried to be, but they only have 20 minutes. The system's not working for you. The quackery places like this, where you spend all your thousands of dollars, they pretend to be, but they still don't get to the root cause. Maybe they just get you to pay for their time so they can work on your nutrition, physical activity, your sleep, your stress reduction. Because sometimes that is the cause of the fatigue in a very holistic manner. But to be holistic, the true word of holistic, we need to do all these other appropriate evaluations and truly get to the root cause. And these quacks have hijacked it and marketed it.
Sometimes even having that kind of a face-to-face encounter where you feel more heard from somebody itself has a significant therapeutic effect, a placebo type.
It does. Right? It does. And I try my best to, you know, be that source of a person. But even then, I mean, we don't all have all the time in the world. And I know patients are frustrated.
Dr. Carl walks in and goes, it's not your thyroid, and slams the door. I want to shift.
As my hair starts to gray.
I want to shift gears. I want to talk about shotgunning huge panels of labs, because I think Austin has done a good job at talking about pretest probabilities and why just getting huge just huge amounts of these batteries of labs is probably not a good idea. We can also talk about whole body MRI scans and things that, where you get spurious findings. But Austin, maybe you can explain pretest probability and like why just if you just get a huge swath of labs, that's not good.
Yeah, I think the general public has a sense or a belief, and even a lot of clinicians do too, that we're all trained in medical education and residency to go through like the subjective portion of our assessment when we get the patient's story, and then we have the objective portion of the assessment, like lab data and things like that. And I think characterizing it as objective makes us feel like it is always the truth and it is perfectly accurate, and that leads us to things like imaging tests, for example, which again, there's some interesting overlaps here with the pain world of people getting MRI scans for back pain, for example. And those are surprisingly less helpful and accurate and reliable than people think, even though like MRI is held up as a gold standard for finding anything that's wrong. It's the answer donut, right? And the same with blood tests, that people feel like I have this hard number in front of me. It tells me exactly what's going on. If it is normal, then it's normal. If it's abnormal, then I need to do something to bring it back into range. However, all tests are imperfect. Some are way more imperfect than others. And with each test's kind of diagnostic performance, we call these like performance statistics of a given test, that basically alters the probability of a given condition. So we have to come into our objective assessment when we're going to do these labs and imaging tests and things like that with some sense of what is the likelihood of this problem in this given individual? Because if they have an extremely low probability of having this particular condition and I test for it, and that test comes up positive, there is often a pretty decent chance that was a false positive test for that person. And the proportion of the time that is the case will vary from test to test. And similarly, there are certain situations where I might see and talk to a patient like in the ER for something, and I am so confident that they might have something, but the first test might have been negative. And I say, this is screaming this diagnosis to me. I do not believe that test. And I might either treat them anyway for that thing, or I might, retest or find another different way to get at that particular diagnosis. And this is really hard to do. It's really hard to teach. I work with residents all the time and getting them to, assess what do they think is the probability of a given condition and kind of fold that into their thought process it takes years to get. I don't even know that I'm, phenomenal at it, but with certain things that I see more or less often, like a pulmonary embolism or something like that, it's like I am thinking very hard about what is the likelihood of this before I ever pull the trigger on a given test. And that is in stark contrast to what a lot of these other folks do, where they take no accounting whatsoever of probabilities. And they just order massive slews of tests that become very difficult to interpret, if not are outright impossible to interpret on the back end.
Yeah. And a lot of those tests have not been validated for anything, let alone what they're even, maybe why they're ordering it.
And then they end up in the endocrine clinic.
How do I fix my pregnenolone level?
I don't think I saw the lab results of what you sent. I don't think I want to see the lab results of what they sent, but at least you said they were at least in the normal reference ranges that they were given. But, and I talk about that stuff to patients all the time because, everyone's heard this, but the reverse T3s and all these things. And in endocrine labs, they are the assays and the how these assays are done and how they perform and how they're validated to help us, like you said, statistically figure out if someone has something based upon that pretest probability. I can't even explain that stuff. I have to like review it before I would really explain it. I just say they're complicated and they're not perfect. A similar one, we've talked a lot about continuous glucose monitoring, Spencer, on this podcast, and people don't realize that they're not perfect. Mm-hmm. And then they don't realize that the point of care glucose measures are not perfect. And to some degree, even like a lab blood glucose, it's hard to explain to people.
There's error bars surrounding the thing. And what Austin, you alluded to this, but it's like, if you run all these tests and you have a pretest probability in your mind, and again, the what you're seeing is screaming a particular diagnosis, even if it's negative and you just don't believe it. What's really going on under the hood, your hood, is like, I don't want to miss this potentially fatal error, in diagnosis. Yeah. And so it's like, in this particular case, it's like, okay, you did all this shotgun, a sawed-off shotgun because it sprayed everywhere. And you got all of these lab results, but you're missing a potential fatal, in this case, diagnosis, because you did not actually go through this in a systematic way with an idea of like, all right, if I get these results back and it says this, here's how I'm going to proceed. It's more like we're testing for everything and whatever we identify, we're just going to stop there and quote unquote treat that.
I suspect there's a good chance that this individual would have gotten the same set of treatment plan and supplementation regardless of what the lab results showed.
Yeah, it's a copy and paste thing.
It's all incoherent. Yeah. It's just, there's no way that, I mean, that's crazy.
So there's no thought process here. And I assume there's some sort of a, I don't know, like a dismissal of liability or something like that on their end, because it's like, there's no way that a intelligent physician should sign up to that kind of a practice if they're making those recommendations, risking that they could be missing something as morbid as like a, you know, colorectal cancer or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough.
I think people listening may, the COVID pandemic, they may know the antigen test versus PCR. Just because one of those is positive doesn't mean it's, you know, you have it, and vice versa. I think people probably learned a lot through that, but we see a lot of like testosterone.
Or they decided that they don't trust mainstream medicine.
Yeah.
Because as we learned and developed that, you know, because people are, they assume that all of our tests are perfect, and then they get, and then there's this misconception that breeds, discontent kind of thing.
Yeah, and distrust, general
endocrine
general
labs,
distrust.
Testosterone, prolactin, DHEA, they're testing these things just without, you know, any necessarily
hypogonadal clinical context.
Yeah, I don't know how to really interpret a pregnenolone level in like a middle-aged male.
Nobody does.
I don't think the girl can either.
Nobody. There's not. We would never order that because it's irrelevant. Yeah. There's not any clinical entity that we would check that for to be able to do anything, because we're looking for disease states, right? Again, we want to be holistic. We want to use our pretest probability of what the heck is we think might be going on and not miss severe disease and then kind of go from there, right? And so, yeah, there's just no reason.
Yeah, you mentioned the error bars around these like hormone tests, and then layer on the complexity of a lot of them have like various circadian type biology goes up and down at certain times of day. And then there's like feedback loops that you have to interpret. And that's always like med students' bane of their existence. Is this test normal when it shouldn't be normal, or is it abnormal and it's appropriately abnormal? And so, you know, that leads me into my other common source of concern is direct to consumer like lab testing, where people just buy whatever labs they want. Because I'm sure you guys do too. I end up with a lot of people who seek out consults with me. They say, I got these labs done. What do I do with them? And I'm like, before I even look at these numbers, give me some backstory. Tell me why they were obtained. Because that backstory, that why they were obtained, what led you to go and, you know, do whatever searching you did and add these to your cart and purchase them and get them drawn, like something should have led you to do that. That's what informs my pre-test probability of things. And they're like, oh, nothing. I just wanted to get checked. I felt fine. Then I'm like, I can probably take most of these and put them in the trash, except for perhaps a blood pressure measurement and a blood lipid measurement. Like those are the things that I would actually want to pay attention to in somebody who otherwise feels fine, you know, on average.
Yeah. You don't want to create more barriers to care, certainly, right? But at the same time, if you know, kind of open all this up and people can get whatever labs, whatever imaging stuff that they want, you create this market for inappropriate testing, inappropriate treatment, and you're creating more medical problems that you're solving potentially. Especially, I mean, this would have been 50 different medications/supplements, right? And it's like the likelihood that there's an interaction that is unwanted is almost is nearing 100%, right? And then you don't even know what to expect, so there's nothing that you can like monitor other than like how you feeling. And let's rerun all these tests just to make sure we don't see anything bad, to the extent that you can actually detect that.
And the risk of unnecessary procedures too. You know, I often tell the story about several years ago when I was in fellowship, you know, as I was learning about papillary thyroid cancer. And now, once upon a time, anybody who was diagnosed with it probably had it clinically diagnosed. So it was big and it was probably high risk. They got the whole thyroid taken out, radioactive iodine, blasted them with it. And then they had their TSH suppressed with high dose levothyroxine hormone, right? That's how they used to do it. And then it turns out that a lot of these smaller ones, they start to become incidentally found. Everyone's doing CT scans, ultrasounds. And these little bitty ones, they don't necessarily always behave like a true cancer. Some of them we don't even have to take out anymore. Some we only take out half the thyroid. A lot of people don't need the radioactive iodine therapy anymore. And so, you know, it just goes to show we've historically done sometimes because we didn't know any better. Also, you know, we learn as we go, but there's a real risk of doing more harm than good. In South Korea, they did this experiment where they started doing neck ultrasounds on everybody just as a screening thing. And their incidence of papillary thyroid cancer skyrocketed. Their mortality, their complications of it stayed flatlined down at like 1%. So a lot of people got their thyroids taken out unnecessarily.
Yeah, there's this claim to bring it back to Spencer's like mention of low testosterone, like, oh, testosterone levels have been declining and this and the other. And so you got to get checked, right? And it's like, yeah, so we're testing for it a lot more now. We're testing for it in a different way that's more accurate, more precise, more reliable. And we also have like co-occurring epidemics of obesity, sleep apnea, things like that that can be contributory and causative. And so it's like, you need to compare apples to apples, and then also just flat out stating, oh, testosterone levels have declined, should not be like the impetus to just go get your testosterone level checked without symptoms, without making sure that any sort of contraindications to treatment. And I guess what I'm saying is you shouldn't, in addition to just getting tested, but initiating treatment, like there's a whole, you got to go through.
Without doing the full evaluation. We've talked a lot about that. But yeah, this goes back to your pretest probability. If you have real symptoms, we're going to evaluate you. We're going to confirm the diagnosis. Then you need a whole evaluation to get to the root cause. This comes back to the root cause thing all the time. And these places, they market it and then they don't actually do it. And then we have to do it. And unfortunately, people end up on all these medications and it's hard to then do it. It's really hard to do it.
The problem is that they're gurus and they're power lifters, not cool power lifters, smart power lifters like you, someone just sent me a video of it's one of the big time power lifters. I don't even want to mention their name. It's like, if your testosterone's 600, something like if it's 600 and they're not giving you testosterone therapy,
oh my God,
you need to go see another clinician.
Oh boy.
Who's selling anabolic steroids is what they need to go see.
I see this all the time. Yeah. It's just kind of like, Jesus. Oh my God.
Yeah. Maybe the attitudes of, well, in that particular sort of, we'll call it like, I don't know, optimization field. Like if you're in that, you're curious about different agents, different sort of treatments and whatnot. And so you're already like keyed up to want to try some of these things. And so, yeah, you get into the space and you're kind of lured in by other folks who are, we could call it like PED curious or PED supporters. And yeah, I don't know. It ultimately,
and by PED for the people listening, performance enhancing drugs.
Yeah, yeah. Not limited to just anabolic steroids, but also stimulants, also, you know, other
sorts of stuff.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, and putting just a number out there, testosterone level of 600. It's like, yeah, okay. So there's like a wide range here in addition to like known hypogonadism associated with exercise that's asymptomatic and like you wouldn't necessarily treat for those things because the risks outweigh the benefits. And so, but that level of nuance is effectively missing from that market. I mean, you don't hear people on the Joe Rogan Experience or like their YouTube channel with a million subs and views and stuff saying like, yeah, so, you know, this may not be appropriate for you or like you should approach this with some, you know, a high level of skepticism. That's never involved. There's no caveats. It's more like,
nobody likes
yeah,
that.
You should do this. You'll be better. You'll be better nobody for sure.
That's also not how they make money.
Well, that's
telling people you probably have sleep apnea and drink too much alcohol and could afford to, you know, reduce your waist measurement a little bit and that'll fix your testosterone is
nobody wants to hear that.
Less sexy.
I'll tell you what they do ultimately, you know, when they if they have obesity associated hypogonadism with sleep apnea and stuff and they come and see, you know, I think you guys do obesity medicine and whatnot. If they come and see somebody like us and we say, hey, we do a full evaluation. We actually treat the underlying root cause and, you know, and it might require medication or surgery to help them with their obesity, but then they get their sleep apnea fixed and their testosterone normalizes and they feel great. Yep. That's pretty rewarding for those people.
Should have just put them on test cypionate, 200 milligrams, go for it.
worsen their sleep apnea and like,
yeah, yeah. Polycythemia, the whole thing. Yeah, you don't need to worry about that. You're fine.
Increase cardiovascular risk. Yeah, but they feel great.
Yeah. Yeah, you can lift more weight or something. I don't know.
A couple of days.
So that's kind of what we wanted to discuss. I don't know if we have anything more, but we kind of want to go a little bit more into depth of this. We're probably going to do some YouTube videos and more podcasts about maybe this specific case a little bit more and probably do a little bit more research into these specific clinics that are, I think it's straight up malpractice, but I don't know how they're getting away with this.
Maybe we can get our journalist friends to help, but we got to stay legally we don't want to get in trouble somehow by, you know, like you said, someone you guys said, we don't want to get slanderous.
Yeah, yeah.
Or something, well, even though it's true.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not going to say anything that's not true.
Yeah, if you're telling the truth.
Well, I'd be curious to hear from your audience. You know, everybody's listening to this is probably also on social media. Like, let us know what you want to hear. We could do a whole Mythbuster mm-hmm. series and get it going. Yeah. Because this is not an isolated incident, unfortunately, and not an isolated organization, unfortunately. So if you're on social media, tag us, comment, whatever, do the whole thing. So that way, you know, we can kind of guide this myth busting series. I think that'd be not only provocative and entertaining, but also very helpful to people who are trying to navigate this space without medical training. And that's ultimately what I think it comes down to. We have the general public who they want to feel better, they want to perform better, and they're being influenced whether they think they are or not by these very powerful figures without the requisite sort of medical knowledge to like determine, that's BS or that's legit, and like sort through it. Because we don't want to say everything is BS, but if most of it is, and so you got to kind of be nuanced in your approach and how you kind of sift through this stuff.
It is sad to me and probably you guys that there are, you know, there are fellow physicians who go down this hole and they end up doing this, and it's inappropriate. And it's not just physician, but you know, other clinicians that could play a beneficial role for people if they did what they're supposed to do. I mean, to all the, you know, even the semi-alternative type things. I mean, you know, they just kind of did what they're supposed to do and help people out without going down these inappropriate marketing money grab issues.
Yeah.
It's just too bad.
Thanks for coming on, both Dr. Jordan, Dr. Austin. I think we'll probably have Dr. Jordan back on. He is actually an expert in PEDs, but not performance enhancing.
Austin's like, what the hell? What happened to me?
Not performance enhancing drugs, but penile enhancement devices. So
that's right. Yeah.
It's not mine, baby.
It's not mine. Honestly, it's not mine.
Yeah, at least it's the consecutive episode that I've been fired from my job.
Thank you. Any closing comments?
Thanks, guys.
Good. We'll be chatting soon. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.